Welcome back to episode 12 of the Slide In Podcast. I'm Braden Anderson alongside Kelly Gallup.
Hello.
We've been off for a few weeks.
You've been off for a lot longer than that.
I've been off for a little while. I took a little vacation.
Africa.
I did go to Africa. It's a long way.
He's now threatening to quit and go down and be a guide in Botswana or wherever you were.
Yeah, Botswana. Yeah, that's where I was. Yeah, I don't know. Animals are cool. I like them a lot. But, you know, you've got border collies. They're good too. So we're going to get into a bunch of stuff today. We've got a bunch of listener asked questions. If you guys have questions for us, throw them in the comments on our YouTube channel, or on Instagram. We love talking about this stuff. And at the rate we're going, we'll probably get through maybe one and a half in this hour 20 or so that we're going to record. I would love to go back and fish in Africa, mainly because it's warm there right now. It was negative 17 on the drive-in this morning.
I thought, here, you know, first time in my 25 years here, this week, you know, I got the house in Ennis, or outside of Jeffers, and we had every morning for a week, was between 7 and 16 below. And West Yellowstone was 36 degrees. First time I remember in history of the world, at least my world, Yellowstone was the warmest spot in Montana. I mean, up north, it's like 20 below. Here, 36. And I called down and talked to Shirley, and she said, oh, it's melting everywhere. It was the craziest shit. But this morning when I walked over, I thought, I walked out, man, I had about 20 layers on. I might take that breath, you know, whether your nose hairs freeze or not, and you go, it's really, it feels great. And yeah, I thought it was about 5 below. Not bad.
Here,
that was the warmest I've felt in forever.
It was like, I don't know.
Maybe two, not even.
2 or 3 in Bozeman, negative 17 in Norris, and closer to 0 here.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. It was, but that's why we're here.
That's why we're inside. We're going to go film a Midge video whenever the weather allows. I mean, it's got to be a lot closer to 30.
We could walk out there eating right now.
Yeah.
Guarantee you.
I don't wonder how long that camera gear is going to last in that kind of weather, or the camera guy. I don't do that well with the cold.
Fish guy would be like one fish and say, see you later.
Yeah. So we're going to do a Midge video. And of course, we'll talk a lot of dry flies in that and show you techniques and everything. But we've seen a lot of comments on our YouTube channel asking us to talk about dry flies. So I think we're going to do a lot of that today. One of the comments I just wanted to start with was from Carlisle Flynn Fowl on YouTube. And said, what's your favorite memory of dry fly fishing? What do you look for when designing a dry fly? Any secret tying tricks? So that's 3 questions. Let's start with the first one. Not necessarily your favorite memory, but what's a great dry fly fishing memory that you have?
I mean, just simple eats. My absolute favorite dry fly fishing memory in history was 3 years ago when I hunt that big hen that I did not catch when I was during the rules session. And I had a month of hunting that fish. I believe I touched her 7 or 9, I don't remember now, I've got it wrote down. I fished her for 17 nights visible, I could see her. But that was during the rules, and I had to fish, I had to pick my fly before I left. And I only get to pick an EP or a spinner one night out of that. I can't take what I know they're eating.
Right.
And I bowed out on that fish. We've talked about that story before, but I hooked her 3 times where she just took off and no drag, no nothing, just took off and fly just popped out. And first night was on an ant and then a caddis, and then it was horsehair tippet week or whatever. I don't remember what it was. I didn't fish. But yeah, that was my favorite hunt ever in my life. And I never touched the fish. Well, I hooked her multiple times, but not more than a 6-foot run.
Yeah.
And it was, but it was the fact that, and if I lined the fish, I only get 3 shots on rules night. rules month. And so if I make a bad cast, that's one. And then if I line them, whatever it is, everything's a disc, you know, a penalty. And so, but I every time I got her, it was first cast. And every time if she snubbed me, you know, I only get three shots. And right. So that was my favorite time. But my two of my favorite memories of dry fly fishing, because they were light bulb moments, right? And kind of the same thing, because they both start with Dave Ellis, who I've spoke about a lot. And Dave was so instrumental in my fly design and my behaviors of that stuff. But I snuck up on him on this, around the south branch of the Sable, upstream of the chapel, I think. I can't remember exactly where we were. But there's this moment in time during a sulfur hatch where they would, or not a hatch, excuse me, spinnerfall. And the sulfurs, which is the equivalent of our, that's the Western PMD, all right? We got sulfurs back there. And they would come down, and there's this 20-minute window where it's just maddening. You can't get, they're eating everywhere, and you can't get one to eat it. I mean, it's just like, and so, and I'm coming into that window, and I kind of sneak, it's a peninsula. And I snuck over it, and I see Dave. And Dave's down in the water, and he's got his face in the water like this. And I'm like, has he had a stroke? What the hell's going on? And he comes up, wipes his face, and he goes, he doesn't. And I think he saw me. And so I walk down, and he says, how you doing? He says, oh, great. He goes, man, that always amazes me. And I'm like, no, I'm baited. And I know I'm just like totally screwed, because he's just like a light years ahead of me. And I said, yeah, this drives me crazy too. What the hell are you talking about? He goes, you know how they come, how the spinners all come down and they won't eat them unless they only eat the, he says, you know how the spinners come down at first 20 minutes or so, and they'll only eat the ones with a 40-degree cant to their wings. And I go, oh, that. Oh, yeah, hell yeah. What the hell? I go, what are you talking about? And he flips one of the greatest fly tires ever. And he opens this Wheatley swing leaf, and there's got to be hundreds of sulfurs with their wings all at a 40-degree cant so they don't touch the water. And that was like the wow. I don't know if it was a mind blower. It was almost like, I'm done. I'm quitting. Yeah, yeah. It was just, you know. And then the other one was on the Boardman River, just below Brown. Dam's gone now, Brownbridge Dam. I fished that section, shit, 4 or 5 nights a week for all year for 20 years. And just 100 yards of water. That's where I'd go at night to decompress, like I do here. When I go downstream, I do the same thing. Sometimes I wouldn't make it 30 yards. And I just, but that night, I was catching fish like crazy. That's what this book, Spinners, was based on. And I was upstream, just a little ways from the bridge, and I am putting on a clinic on these fish. I mean, the fish in Michigan are tough. They're tough. If you can catch fish there, you know, you can catch them anywhere. It's just the pressure's there, right? And so, but I'm having one of these nights, and I'm on just, it's spectacular. It's like I've told you before, sometimes it's good to be Kelly. That night was good to be Kelly. And so, but I noticed the fish were eating spinners, but they were eating mine better. That's what my ego told me. They would just, you know, the fish are sitting there just doing their beautiful rhythms, you know, and you're watching this. And my fly come, they did it even better. And I never missed a fish, which, you know, doesn't happen to me very often. And I was on my 7th fish when my ego finally took a break, thinking that, you know, I'm just like Joe Brooks incarnate. And I'm like, why are they changing their cadence? What is happening here? The first two, I just thought, man, I must have made a great hook cast, and he's just so convinced he wants somebody else to eat it, right? Because there's a handful of fish on the run. And I was like, and then the next one, I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm that good. The third one, it's like, why are none? And by the 7th one, I finally went, wow, this is a Dave Ellis moment. and I better pay attention. So unlike Dave, I went to the shore, I got naked. It was the runs too deep. It was like up to here, right? So I just went, I might have my underwear. I doubt it. I think I just went out and took all my clothes off and went out and I got in the water and I just leaned down in the water and I was looking, it's kind of getting dusk, right? It's not really bright out, but it's, you can see, and it's, I don't know, it's July or probably, and it's probably, you know, 8:30, 9 o'clock. And I'm just looking at these bugs and I cannot, nothing. I'm freezing to death, all kinds of shrinkage going on. I need out of this plane. And so I take off, right? And so I come back the next night and I didn't even bring a rod and reel. And it had been a really good spinnerfall for, I don't know, probably 4 or 5 days. So I come back and I had chafing dishes, just big pans. And I just sit there and they were coming down and, you know, 30, 40 at a time. I think I had 3 of them. And so I would sit in the water and I would just put the pan down. I'd see them come and I'd just like dip them and dip them and dip them. I didn't want to net them and throw them in something because I wanted to see what the hell was happening. Right. So I'd dip them and I'd dip them. And man, I got a shit ton. I mean, I thought I had just a few. When I got home, I had like 150 bugs, right? I'd go to shore and I'd have, you know, the thing wasn't much bigger than this thing, right? And I would just kind of like scoop them and they'd get some in there and scoop them and get some in there. And it took about 20, 30 minutes. And then I just went, put them in the car and drove home. And everything was fine. I got there. And the pan that I was looking at, it's like the size of this. And I took a fly and there's all these, and I just keep looking at them and I don't really see anything. And then I took the spinner I was fishing and I threw it down the water. And I asked my daughter, Madison, who was 5 maybe, I don't know, out of the mouths of babes. And by design of the fly, we, especially in the late 70s, 80s, if somebody was a really great tire and they did one, I like to think of the cut wings, and they'd see these cut wing flies, which just spun the living shit out of your leaders. And I never seen them fish that well, even if you could get one not to spin your leader. But this was a spinner, and it was a good looking spinner. And I threw it down in there, and I was, because at first I sat there staring at these bugs and staring at them, and nothing's really coming to me. Because it, in history of fly fishing, when professional anglers say this looks like something, it's almost like 99.5% of us go, it looks like something. Yeah, this is a cat.
It's the echo chamber.
It's a duck. Yeah. And this fly was like, gah, you know, just spinner. Like it's a 2 split tail body and just a wing, right? And I'm just sitting there, and Madison's was really, you know, very artsy kid. And I'm sitting there looking at these things and I'm like, man, nothing's coming to me. And I threw the fly in there and I walked over, and Madison walked over and she said, what are you doing? And a very inquisitive child. And I said, well, does that fly look like those bugs? She's, no, it doesn't look anything like them. It looks like it's electrocuted. And I'm like, I thought it was a great spinner because I've been told my whole life that's what a spinner is.
Right.
And the amount of wrong to the fly, I mean, just the fact that the wing is like 10% of the overall body when it's really about 70. And I mean, but I've been told this my whole life and I've seen these spinners. And I mean, this is what a spinner looks like. And this is a really good one. And it was like, she goes, no, it looks electrocuted. And I looked at it and I'm like, shit, it really does. It looks, and that's when I went, they weren't eating my fly better. They were refusing that thing at the last minute. I just got lucky, all 7 of those, right? It wasn't that. The next night, you would have got none of those fish, not one. They would have went, oh, and you, oh shit, and you'd have brought it back and you'd change your fly and you started messing with stuff. But that night, flat luck. I mean, it just must have been just enough that they're, you know, because they're just at the end, they would refuse, but I'd get them. And so I sat looking at those flies, and that's when I realized half of the wings were only one showing. It was a single, like most spinnerfalls, most of the flies, like on this cover of this book, most of the flies, I don't know if you can see, we'll show it in a minute.
Hold that up in front of your face.
In front of my face? Yeah, I can't see the thing. But I mean, most of them, they lay on their side. At least, and I don't care what spinnerfall it is, at least half of them do that, right? And so, and then I started looking at, well, if there's only one wing, and then you started looking at the bodies and realizing that the wing isn't 10%, it's not 20%. Most of the times, if you look at one, even if it is crucifixion style, like this, when you take that down, it goes down and it comes in, hence the triple, the Dave Ellis's first guy to identify that triple wing spinner, for just three different lengths, and he shaped it. And then the dolly wing that does them, and the cripples so that they're down. Because in reality, you get about, in some flies, trichos in particular, you can see almost 90% wing silhouette to body length. And so identifying the fact that one wing across 10% isn't enough, 50's probably getting there closer. Because when you reduce your fly, the greater the margin of error is. When the fly gets smaller and you do 10% wrong, overall value looking at it might be 60% to the fish, right? So probably that, as far as memories, I mean, obviously fishing memories of dry fly eats, they're just so, I'll tell you one of my favorite memories ever. And it's always, is when we shot that Betis thing and I brought all the old equipment and I didn't have one size 20 fly. And I knew they'd eat an 18 and I got my ass kicked. I mean, I hooked three or four, but I couldn't land one.
Yeah, I think.
But that was such a visual. First of all, we were up between the lakes and I mean, oh my God, it's snowing, winter, but it's sunny, or snowy, not snowing. Sunny, huge fish just gobbling dry flies, getting your ass kicked on camera, which that was fun.
Well, I think so.
That was like, I think the learning moments, I can't really tell. I can't tell you 10 fish that ate dry flies that I can remember right off. I mean, if Johnny was here, he would jog my memory. But I mean, one of my favorite ones when that giant ate that zoo cougar. That was a good dry fly.
Yeah, that was a good dry fly.
But as far as dries go, I think my favorite one on this river was at night, not night, but it was a spinnerfall at the down below here, and the waves were coming into shore, and I saw this fish's back. He's literally, I forget that not everybody is watching these things. And so I've been looking at a couple of them lately and I use my hands as references. Most people don't have a clue what I'm talking about, as if I scatter off in different places enough. But this fish was probably 4 to 8 inches from shore. And there's a little chop coming in off a big wave train out in the middle. And every time he would eat, and I'd see, it was a big fish, it was like a 21, 2-inch brown. And every time he would eat, his head would go down and his body would get rolled into the shore, literally hit the bank.
Yeah.
And he'd kind of kick out a little bit and he'd start his cadence again. But every time he'd lift his head off, he's probably in maximum of 6 inches of water. And he's on such a deliberate, slow motion, you know, the light's just, you got maybe a half hour left of light, and he's coming up, and it's got that chromey look to it. And all of a sudden, as soon as his head would break, it'd break the chrome of the surface. And he'd eat, and his head would go down, and his whole body would roll to the left, and he would be on the bank. And then he'd just ride the wave back out and start all over again. And threw one up on him, and he ate it. And it was just cool. He ate like the rest of them. When a fish eats like every other eat, it tells you you've won. You know, there's no panic. And usually it's when you
slow,
see,
yeah.
They eat it and they don't take off running. They eat it and then you got to set the hook. And that's what makes them run. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, One of the eats of yours that sticks out in my head was the dry fly day we did when we went from Windy down to Powell. Short float. And you started off fishing chocolate cows. Oh. They're all over.
Yeah.
Then you flipped over to, I think it was a hackle stacker.
Hackle stacker.
Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that was a 20-ish inch brown trout. It's really, really nice fish, especially on a dry fly. And, you know, we both saw it live. And then turns out we caught it on the GoPro, too, because I was rowing, so I wasn't using the big camera. But you could just see the inside of, you know, you see the beak, right, and the point of the nose, and just so slow. It's the slowest eat.
That was a, we fished that for a while, didn't we? Weren't we on anchor?
No, that was rolling.
We were rolling?
Yeah, it was rolling.
Oh, I remember. It was right below the one we kept, we saw it, and we didn't get it. And yeah, that was that deliberation, that just so, I'm committed because you've done everything right, right? It's just something. By the way, I just thought of something while you were saying that about casting that I want to go over with when we get to it. Don't let me forget this casting thing. I was doing a rant, something we posted about 20-foot bullshit on that. Yeah, don't let me forget that.
Okay, I'll add that to our list. Because
in this book, I brought up something about this distance casting for trout. And when I say, I'll just do it now. Because
By the way, real quick. Cripples and Spinners was Kelly's first book.
Second book.
Slidein.com. Great book. I've read most of it. I should probably read all of it.
But I said, you know, to take an 8.5-5 dry fly fish and think you can cast more than 20 feet is bullshit. When I say that, it is bullshit in a respect. That's 20 foot of fly line. And what people don't realize, I'd frequently do it in the shop because they're always talking about 65 feet, which is how long this shop is. I says, all right, let's go out and see if you can even see one at 65 feet. But in a trout world, wading around, even in a boat, when you throw 20 foot of line, you probably have got, in a dry world, you know, a lot of people like to go to 12, but let's just say you're standard 9 or 10 foot leader guy. And now you've got your line is 20 feet of your cast. Now you've got your leader, that's 30 feet. And then you got rod extension and arm. So you could easily be at 30 feet, 35 feet. But you really should go out and just measure those off and see once you're, how much, you know, I was talking about casting 20 foot of fly line because most people go out in the driveway and try to pull 60 and 70 feet of fly line. But when you take leader and that and off the tip of the rod, what I'm referring to. And when I was writing Cripples and Spinners, we found that we were asking people to mark their fly line with a Sharpie at where they thought they're, like, they were marking it at their finger, right? Where they're, just go out and fish and tell me, you know, what, okay, I'm fishing and this is good. I'm after a trout. Nobody can see me, so I'm not hero casting. And most people had 17 feet at their finger. That's taking away the rod.
Yeah.
So in other words, you got 10, 15 feet off the tip of the rod and you're, you know, 20 feet off the tip would be a 30 foot cast, you know, to a rise. When I was always talking about dry fly fishing. You know, shit, I try to get within 15 feet of them if I can.
I mean, as close as you can, stalk really, without more. Stepping on them.
Yeah. Stalk more, cast less. But I remembered that when they were, because we were talking, that it's some short you put out or something about dry fly.
Yeah, there's something about, you said you hate distance casting. And
for trout.
Know, yeah, and then, you know, of course, there's a couple people saying, if you ever fish the ranch, you need to throw it 40. You know, you're saying, well, with 20 feet of fly line, you are throwing it 40. Especially
with rod extension.
Yeah, rod extension and leader. And on the ranch, especially when guys are throwing 15-foot leaders, 18-foot leaders.
Yeah.
Then, you know.
As long as you can. Leaders are great if you can control your leader.
Yeah, if you can turn
But if
over.
You cannot. Well, you got to be able to make it do more than just turn over.
Right.
If the leader goes out and it's straight, That's great. You got dragged. And
so why don't you explain this? Because this was a big light bulb moment for me, this concept of leader control, not just, you know, having it unroll and look pretty, but actually being able to manipulate the bend in your leader, the angle of your leader. It really helps with your drift. So
I mean,
kind of dive into that.
It doesn't really matter on the dry fly. If your leader's straight, I mentioned this, Gary LaFontaine talked about this forever ago when graphite first came out. He said it's ruining anglers because it makes straight line casters. Meaning everybody goes out and just wants to show everybody how far they can cast. All you got to do is go to any casting pond and watch guys or girls. They start their casting and they don't even think about the ones that just puddle up on the end and do a giant tailing loop. And then you get to the target zone where you have to hit targets. And you watch the wheels fall off a wagon of an average, not even average, great caster at that 40 mark. And you watch that hula hoop get really tiny. You got a freaking 3-foot hula hoop out there, and it's 40 feet away, and you've been telling people you're casting 60 feet with a size 16 PMD, 18 PMD, 60 feet away. I say, bullshit. I'll go with anyone that wants to go with me at $1,000 a cast and see how many times that's successful. I mean, I did it out here. A guy told me he could hit a Dixie cup at 65. I said, I got $5,000 sitting right here. If you can hit it once, I'll give it to you. And I don't give a shit how many casts you got. 65 feet's the length of this building. Blimey. I don't know if I could see goddamn Dixie cup 65 feet away from here. Right? It's just that thing where we, same with, I was asking Andy Mill about this, about how often he cast 80 feet. He goes, what? So I'm like, it's for tarpon, for God's sake. And he goes, what? Are you kidding me? And I go, no, I just hear it all the time. And it's not a shot at anybody. And everybody's, their egos get blown up, right? And they just go, oh, my God. But if you actually go out and you realize on the ranch, I've never cast 40 feet of line to a fish on there. I've tried it. There's a section down below Osborne where I swear to God the fish have some sort of radar. And you get there and they're feeding 30 feet from you, and then you step in the water and they're 35 feet. And you try to set that cast. You got to have, you know, back to the leader. If you cannot control your leader, if you throw and your leader straightens out, just think of the physics of this. If the leader's straight to the fly, you're here. If your rod, even if it's in the water, the surface current catches your fly line before anything. The mass is greater than the other, than the leader. And so you almost immediately have drag. So now you say, I do a reach cast. Ooh, there we go. That's beautiful. So you do a reach cast and get your line upstream of your fly, theoretically, but you're still tight, and the current still catches it. If your leader does not serpentine or hook a cast of a bend, you really, you've got a second or two. And yeah, you can get lucky on it. But as I said in one of the other things, one of my favorite dry fly moments that Renee Harrop doesn't know happened, I was down above Millionaires on the ranch, pretty sure I was just above there, and watched Renee Harrop stalk a fish. It's the only time I've ever seen Renee Harrop fish in my life. And I just sat in the boat. I saw him. He did not see me. And I watched him. And it took him forever. I say 10 minutes. I don't know if it took 10 or 3 or 5. I have no idea. I just watched him stalk a fish and get so close to that thing and make one cast, hook the damn thing and land it. It just doesn't happen on the ranch. And it was like, there was no, so the control thing, straight upstream is one thing. But straight upstream, your angle has to be such that you're some way behind the fish and still going to get the fly to go over the fish before the leader does, which means theoretically you should have a little bit of a curve to your cast somehow, or at least be able to serpentine your you know, make your leader wiggle so that it's got the loop, the ability to drift, which, you know, 6 foot's a long ways. That's a long drift on a dry fly, not from a boat. I mean, that's endless. But, and so it's really control of the leader is everything. Not so much, you know, in giant flies, you get away with a little bit more with foam. You know, now you're skating flies and you're twitching, a south fork twitching and stuff like that. That's a different realm. But in an actual dry fly, to get the fly out there, even on really slick, slick water, there's still a lot of... One thing I see on the Henry's Fork in particular, and it also does it to me on the Yellowstone, but not so much on the Yellowstone as it, unless I'm by the boulders, but on the Henry's Fork, which I would put Silver Creek, you know, Henry's Fork, couple of the eastern rivers that are really heavy pressured, those fish get really savvy. And so, but the water on the Henry's Fork is such as that you got all those weed beds. And when the weed beds, when water goes over top of a weed bed, even if it's slick, it's still moving up and down, right? Even if it looks completely, you always hear glass slick, yeah? Well, it's not. It's got different things happening. And they have a tendency, if one goes up, let's say you're in the middle, you got a 10-foot thing and it's going up and down. The seam is 10 feet wide and 20 feet long, say. And you cast out, and the water, the hydraulics such that it goes over the weed bed, and it doesn't really make a bump so much, but it does, it's got this kind of unevenness to the surface. And every time one goes up and the other one goes down, your leader gets straighter. And you might not even see it. But if you can watch a great guide sit on that river and go, pull out. No, they know. I mean, you're talking, that is micro drag. I mean, I've never seen a river in my life that is more, and not to mention, it takes a lot of heat. I mean, it's got a lot of anglers on it, right? And so just because you can cast that far doesn't mean that you can fish that far. Right. It just means that, you know, if someone there was to see you, you'd look to have a great cast. But when I watch the superstars, they get their control over their leader, and their setup is such that what you don't see is great guides or, you know, just say, cast for that one. There's a setup. There's right. A get in position. Take your time. Get in position. Everybody's afraid the fish will quit eating. If he's going to quit eating, we'd blow a cast. Yeah, yeah. That's pretty much
when you put your line right on top of them, that's when he's going to go down.
Yeah.
So I think one thing that I do sometimes that I think can help illustrate these microcurrents you're talking about, and like, it's hard to tell sometimes when your fly is dragging or whether you have a good drift. And something that...
When the dog barks, you know that you're getting a bad drift.
Yeah, yeah. When the dog barks, you know something's going on.
It was the plow. Get over here.
Okay, so what I was getting at is, you know, these microcurrents you're talking about, especially in these technical fisheries, understanding what your fly is doing is imperative. And sometimes throwing a double dry fly rig, I think, can help illustrate that idea to people. That, you know, when your flies land, generally, they're not going to land, you know, if you have 2.5 feet of tippet, they're not going to land 2.5 feet apart. They may land 2 feet apart.
Not.
Right? You're going to have a little bit of slack.
You better hope they don't go.
You better hope there's some slack in there. Back to this whole idea of slack. Well, when you have a good drift, they'll both be drifting naturally. And then oftentimes you'll see one start to pull away from the other. And that's when you know,
it's caught in the current.
I've got 6 feet here, or I've got 4 feet here. And you know, the whether or not to throw double dries is a debate for some people. I think I do it sometimes. Sometimes I don't. You were doing it down on the South Fork when we were with John.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about double dries versus single?
when I was doing it, I was seeing if I could figure out a color that wasn't the pink, so I didn't have to beg a fly from John.
Right. So you're kind of using it to prospect, right?
Yeah, I was prospecting, but only, and I was running 1 foot of drift. I mean, you could see the fish. Yep. You weren't guessing, right? But I tend to, when I do doubles, and I'll do it sometimes more to figure out what they're on, like if I get a compound hatch, but I got to be in the right water. I mean, I really have to be in water that I can know that I'm not just drowning one of the flies or the other. When I do it, I tend to have a bigger fly up and a smaller fly down. I'm not as big a fan of it. In a boat, it's easier. You know, you get the eternal drift. But in my life, you know, the first 20 years of my life was steelhead, salmon, and technical drive stuff, all hatch stuff, because I grew up in Michigan where all that stuff was taken, you know, with the Swisher and Richards doing all that stuff. And it was more, I found it cumbersome to guide it with two flies. When I did do, and I do double rigs quite frequently, but I'll run a sunk spinner underneath a adult, mm-hmm. right? Or a spinner and a damp spinner.
How far are you
spinner.
Running them underneath when you do that?
Anywhere from 6 inches to 6 inches to maybe 15, 16.
Yeah.
And just depending on how deep the, you know, I'll frequently run. You'll see on virtually any spinner fall, particularly towards the end of it, where you stop seeing heads as much as you see bodies, and you know they're eating the sunk ones. Mm-hmm. And your game just goes up significantly with a sunk fly anyway. And, you know, you get to, usually in a spinner fall, you can't see your spinner that well to use it as an indicator. But on a caddis eat, on a caddis bite, I want a drowned caddis below. That one's almost always 6 inches below the adult. And I will, on this river, in caddis world, on foot, not fishing when they're hatched, you know, when they're pupating and they're, you know, bouncing around out there. But during the egg laying sessions, or just, you know, they're going back, I would say I've caught 70 to 80% of my fish on this river on the sunk caddis. Mm-hmm. Just that far below the adult. I always run it, and that's different. But to do a double dry, because I like to twitch my flies a little bit too, and not so much my spinners, but occasionally, but not so much. But it just makes it, I don't know, it kind of, I think you're almost hoping when you do that. You're not really.
You're not sure you're locked into that.
Yeah, I have never fished so much with guys that were that great. And I fished with a lot of great dry fly, way better than me. They tend to go identify and deliver the goods.
Yes.
You know, they don't, there's not a whole lot of, well, let's try this and this. I do it more on a lake than I do on the river, where I'm static and I sit them and the fish are coming to it. You know, frequently I'll run an ant with a calabatus.
Yep.
You know, spinner. I'll just run that ant up. They're just sitting there. And I might move them just ever so slightly to give a vibration look. But I don't know. I tend to not do so many on the double dry, which I know some people that do it pretty well, right? If I do it from a boat, I don't have as big a problem. But when I'm walking, guiding, I just almost never did it.
Well, it's definitely more cumbersome to cast. You're opening up for way more knots and mm-hmm. just tie-ups from it.
You have to have, if you're going to do a double, in my mind, you have to have even more control over your leader. Because if you can't do anything, if all you can do is throw those flies out there and you have no control over your leader, over the slack in your leader, that's all you're doing is you're just developing slack in your leader so you don't pull against your flies. And I don't know. I used to do a double rig of double trichos on the bighorn a lot But I kept them really close.
Yeah.
Like I got, there's so many bugs, right? It's 6 to 8 inches. Mm-hmm. And the bighorn's a lot like the Henry Spork in the respect, other than the fish are much more cooperative. There are a lot of micro currents that go up and down that, you know.
Yeah, I find I do, I ran a lot of dries on the lake, or a lot of double dries on the lake this year. You know, because I was running a lot of spinner patterns that sit really low, like that dolly wing spinner of yours. Mm-hmm. Like, it's hard to see, especially when you're casting too far because you have ego problems. So I would run a, like, pink post, anything really, mm-hmm. and just as an indicator of where my fly is so that when a fish rises really close to it,
yeah,
I set the hook. So it's, like you said, indicator.
And there's a situation where you can throw more than 20 feet with your 5 weight.
Yeah.
You know, and people tend to, you don't have to, but they tend to fish much further away than they need to on a lake, especially with small flies, you know, because so much of lake fishing is for, around here in particular, is for trichos. It would be for this region, it's Calabatus, trichos, and ants. I mean, and they're all small. So it's, you know, it behooves you to have some sighter in there. And just in case you don't want to do that, you can take, what I do on mine is I will frequently put a piece of yarn 3 foot above my flies. Just a tiny little piece. I put it in there and it's good to go.
Yeah.
It doesn't, I mean, if I just can't, and it has more to do with me on, I'll get in certain of that chromy lights that I just, it, the certain colors of light, and I'm not chromy so much, the water gets chromy, lower light, and I can't pick my fly up.
Right.
I mean, I'm trying to track it. I just put a little half inch piece, not even, quarter inch piece of yarn, or I even used one time, I used those bobber stoppers up there.
Yeah.
And I put one up there, and it, but it sunk it, so I stretched it out, put a little piece of yarn in it. and it worked.
Yeah.
But the pink post, anything that you can see.
So going back to this leader control thing, I kind of use two primary methods to try to put slack into my leader. I'm curious if there's any others you recommend. When I'm fishing really close, like when I'm wading salmon flies, right? I'm throwing 3 to 4 feet of fly line a lot of the time with a 8 foot leader, and you know, I'm slapping them on the bank close mm-hmm. to me. And I find that short range, a hard stop on your forward cast and then almost a kickback.
Mm-hmm.
It will kind of, you know, overpower the cast, propel the fly forward mm-hmm. through its loop, and then it turns over and that fly comes down first and you kind of get a pile of leader behind
yeah.
it. Now, a lot of times with those sand flies, it's, they eat those things quick, and it's close. Mm-hmm. That's not like a technical dry technique.
Yes, it is. There's an actual name for it. I can't, for whatever reason, I know Leon Hansen taught me that 35, 40. He was one of the few guys, a Michigan cat, bamboo guy, incredible angler. I watched him cast the yard with a 5 foot bamboo,
yeah.
cast the grass out there. In front of 50 people.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Oh my God. But what is it? It's not a drop kit. What is it called? It's a relatively over accelerated front cast, and you bring it down, which shock waves your line, and then you drop your rod. And it all goes down the water at the same time. It's a great downstream technique.
I call it
technique.
Like a kick cast or something.
There's a name.
I don't know what it is.
I can't believe somebody's going to call me, so you dumbass.
I think that works better downstream.
That's what it's for.
Yeah, because you get a wave, but...
You do, but you can do the same thing. You can do one and drop it and reach it at the same time.
Right.
It's just a matter of what you're comfortable with. But, and that gives you, on a downstream, it gives you easy 6 feet, right? And I tend to do that with a lot of my... Damn, I can't believe I can't think of the name of the cast. It's everything I do.
Yeah.
He was one of the first guys that I fished with that was that super realm, just unreal fishing casting guys. And so I got to start doing that when I was like he would do it in everything. He could do it upstream, do it any way he wanted. But and in reality, it's kind of like, it's not much. You basically have got a curve, a reach, and a drop cast, whatever it's called. And that's the only way you're going to get anything. You know, you can shake your rod tip, you know, which is basically how you do a curve cast anyway. It's a stop and a set one way or the other.
Right.
You can under, I never liked, like on a right hand curve, you know, under accelerating, you know, trying to keep your loop in your line. Never liked those. I'd rather position, but there's a million ways to do it. I mean, you're the cast guy. I just fish. And so but it's the control of your leader is imperative to everything you do. And that's the difference. And it's why I bitch about distance, because distance is great. It's fun. I like to do it too. We all go out and see who's got the bigger thing. And it's all fun. But in a fishing application is what I do. I don't care. I grew up with Steve and Tim. Not grew up, but I fished with him and I've known him all my life. And I mean, I didn't ever have to wonder. Or Bruce Richards. God dang, Bruce's dad and I fished together. Bruce, same realm, right?
Right.
Bruce Richards, for those who don't know, one of the greatest casters ever, and lives in Ennis now, but he grew up, he was in Traverse City with me. And he designed every SA line there was for 40 years. And one of the greatest casts you've ever seen. And he's a great angler too. But you know, when you're hanging out with those cats, you don't have to really wonder, because you don't just get there for nothing.
Right.
You got to quit fishing. You got to start casting all the time. I wouldn't do that. I said, well, I'll just work on this 40-foot game and we'll stay.
Yeah, there. Yeah. No, I mean, if fishing's your goal, then that's what's important.
But the thing you'll see with, in particular, Bruce, because I have been with Bruce more and I have a lot of pond fish, not ponds, but casting with Bruce. He also has complete control of his leader. And that's the difference. That's what I bitch about when I'm talking about distance tournaments and going to the casting ponds. And you get the most ridiculous thing on earth is they say, okay, you've got 1 minute to make your longest cast. How about you got one shot?
You get one shot, yeah.
And we had a contest here one time where Brooks Montgomery won it. Or maybe Centerson's kid did. I don't remember. And I said, okay, but we're going to have rules. You have to stay in a 10-foot zone. You can't cast outside 10-foot wide. And if your line, if you get a tailing loop, you're out. You're done, just qualified, right? Just because if you're out on the water and you're sitting here doing this bounce back and forth crap trying to cast, and I was out there and I dropped my line and I went out of control and I finally just had this, I was forward and I go like this and I slipped my line, I'm like, no. And I did this ridiculous back because I just threw all my shit on the ground. I said, I'm out. And then, but if you're in a fishing situation, the fact that you get one shot, in reality, you might think you're going to get six, but you're going to get one that's right. And that cast is what, that's the difference. And so if you've got, if at 40 feet you have control over your leader and you can hook it, if you can stop that thing and do a drop cast, whatever, that's not what it's called.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Some people called it a helicopter cast. I remember that too, but that's, I thought it was stupid because my fly, because I think that one's different when it goes up and it drops. I thought that was dumber than shit. Your line's out there. But anyway, when you've got control of the leader, you're fishing. Otherwise, you're just showing off, rather how far you can cast. And so if on the lake, I've seen even on the lake where the double dries, if you're straight lining, or anything really, you know, if you throw too far, that's why I say you don't have to throw that far.
Right.
They'll come to you. They'll get closer. And then you can put a curve in your, that's on a lake is one thing I see frequently. People just, they throw it out there and that line goes really tight. Well, if there's a chop of any sort on the river, on the water surface, not in the river, on the lake, if there's any chop, it starts dragging your fly.
Even like Ennis has microcurrents because it is moving. There's a river in and a river out.
It's there.
It's moving.
So think about your leader more than your...
The other technique I want to bring up, because in theory, the stop and then, you know, the kickback,
mm-hmm.
you can't shoot line. And still end up with slack. And a lot of time, you know, people like shoot. It's hard. So I think the other technique is, you know, you still do your hard stop, but instead of a kickback to introduce slack, you do the tip wiggle as you drop down. And you kind of throw that wave into your line.
You tend to throw it into your line more than your leader.
Yes, yeah. And I think that's the, you know, people are trying to throw it 50 feet. And that that wave, you know, I'm no physicist clearly, but that wave's going to deteriorate as it goes
the reason
out. So it only makes it 30 feet.
The leader is designed to lose its energy. That's right. Why it reduces in size. So it's not going to transfer through your line, and it might. I mean, if you gave it a super whip, it might do something out there. But that's it. Well, that's all you got to know. If you can do that, great.
Yeah.
But if you're just throwing it out there straight, you're not controlling your leader, you're really not fishing to your full potential.
Right.
Because if you can throw that far, you probably could shorten your game and get complete control of your leader. Mm-hmm. And now you're in the fishing realm. And so what we say doesn't mean anything. It's just as a conversation piece, as a guide, aside from downstream dry fly, which is a boat fishing technique, which by the way, if you're in a boat, you fish in front of your boat.
Yeah.
Just especially throw it with downstream. Dry flies. Yeah, throw it downstream. Everybody, You when you throw across current, you're going to have a hard time with life. And so, and I don't care if you're in front of the boat or the back of the boat, figure it out, time it out, but you can get a damn near infinite drift if you're good if in a boat.
Yeah.
I mean, it's eternal in some ways. The right size fly, you could probably run it 100 feet without blinking. But you cannot if you throw it. If you get nothing else out of this, just make sure your line's upstream of your fly, and you'll be fine.
Yeah.
And then
when fishing from a boat.
And in a boat, a reach cast is your friend. That is what makes you really good.
So will you explain a reach cast for people that might not know what it is?
As your line straightens out before it hits the water, you pick your rod upstream of your line, upstream of your fly.
So it's like
midair.
That loop's coming over
you,
right?
I'm trying to pretend like no one's watching us, because one of you dumbasses told me that
anybody
watches it and they listen to them.
Things. Okay,
well, it was like 80% of them.
Let me try to describe this. So as you make your forward cast, the line is followed, and then when your rod tip stops, it starts to develop a loop, right?
Yeah.
And as that loop...
The loop has to straighten.
The loop basically has to pass you, and then you can do whatever you want with your rod tip. That loop's already going that direction.
Yeah.
You're not going to affect the direction of the loop, but what you can do is affect the angle of the fly line closest to your rod, right? So you can push your rod way out to the side and get an angle there, which when you're in a boat and you're kind of crossing currents, ideally, as little as possible. That's what the reach cast does. It allows you to pile all your line in the same current seam.
I like my line to straighten out in the air and reach upstream. It's always upstream because you're in a boat. So I'm already at, even if I'm diagonal, even if I'm going straight across, whatever reason I'm doing that, as it straightens out, you just take, you reach your rod to your right or left, and you move in air the line. It doesn't help when it's on the water.
Right.
That's a mend.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
That's
what a reach cast is.
It's an air mend.
Yeah.
And so, but without the tip flick, you know, you just pull your whole rod goes out to the side and your line realigns in midair. Kind of the same theory of turning a fish's head in midair. You know? You just kind of turn it. And so your whole line gets above it and you're going to get yourself 3 to 10 feet of extra drift. But from a dry fly perspective, because some of that, now you start talking about that in rivers, and I kind of lose my, not that I think it's worse, but there's a difference between boat fishing and wade fishing, and your accuracy and your line control becomes so much more imperative on foot. If you're a foot angler, And I don't care if you're on the Farmington out east, if you're on the Henry's Fork or the Silver Creek or the Moe, I don't care. You have to be a better angler on foot. You have to be, and you have to pay, and you will be more mono a mono. You will be eyeball to eyeball. You will get closer, and you better have a reach, and you better have a curve, and you better have things in your arsenal. And so from the boat can make, there's a couple things that make mediocre anglers great. One's a boat and the second's a guide.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, because going out by yourself when there's, and you know, you don't have that angle when you're on foot, you're down, you're getting closer to the surface of the water. Standing up in the boat, shit, you're 6.5 feet, 7 feet up in the air, your head is. Well, Johnny's head, yeah, mine's like 5.5. Yeah. But it's, life gets real,
yep.
Right? You know, it's like.
Well, you know, then you've got shit in your back cast too.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't have a clean back cast all of a
get
sudden.
Get pushed around.
Start, yeah, and then yeah. You can't just always cast off your right side. Sometimes yeah. You got to flip over and throw backhands. Okay, so another thing I wanted to bring up was some basic casting drills that people can do to try to improve on some of these skills that we're talking about. I think the best way to learn this leader control is actually on grass, because then it's like you say, cut the fly off, or cut
well,
the
it happens
off.
In the air. Your cast well, happens in the air.
No, but what I mean is
so it doesn't matter if you're on grass or water.
No, but I mean if you go to water.
Mm-hmm.
It hits the water and you don't have a visual of how it landed if you're not paying really close attention. Right. And then you're fishing. You're not focusing on trying to improve as much, right? So if you can go, you know, to your local park, your backyard, whatever, when you are on grass, it's a stable medium. And so when that cast lands, you can see if you were successful in having a left or a right yeah. hook or your wiggle or anything. And then
casting ponds too, you can see.
Yeah, casting ponds. Yeah, any like really stagnant water.
Yeah.
So I think there's also a distinction. There are casting drills that are good for wading, and casting drills that are good for being in the boat. Like, remember what we were doing at the grand opening, whatever, a year and a half ago, when we had two frisbees. One's at 25 feet, one's at 40 feet,
mm-hmm.
and they're kind of offset at angles. And we're saying, you know, fly in the hand. You get two back casts, then you have to go at the close one. Then you have mm-hmm. to pick up, and you get one back cast to go at the long one. I thought yeah. that's a great boat drill because you're, you know, it happens fast. You're changing angles, you're moving, and, you know, you might be changing distances too. Versus a wading drill might just be put a frisbee out at 20, 25 feet, and then have something else, you know, offset that you're going to try to curve it around. But, you know, not doing this kind of rapid fire change of direction.
The one thing you didn't mention is how far you can cast. It's funny you had a 25 and a 15 or whatever. That's what I always taught people was two things was you don't get to sit and false cast all day, right? You just get to, and we, like when you go to the competition, you got, you know, 20, 25, or 15, 20, 25, 40, and offset each one, and you get a couple of false casts or whatever. But that's nice for straight lining. But it doesn't teach you a reach cast, doesn't teach you a hook, it doesn't teach you anything else, right? And so back to being on water, fishing, and practicing, you know, you seldom will see somebody casting until they see the fish, right? But they
good
don't
anglers.
Yeah, yeah, they don't. And so, but at some point you have to have practiced something that says, I got to curve that fly to the left a little bit, or I got to do a reach cast upstream. So it would behoove you, much like you watch a pro golfer. I was watching the Pebble Beach last week. and I think I don't think I've ever seen it not happen. A guy makes a bad shot, he sits there for a second after he makes it and he swings the club a couple times. Guy's gonna make $2 million on that today. Like he gives a shit, right? They do.
Yeah.
They do give a shit. And they get in this, they get in the bunker, and you'll see them get done. They'll look at that shot. If it's a good one, they never do it. If it's a bad one, they sit there and they look at their mistake.
Try to figure out what went wrong.
We don't really do that as anglers so much. When you make a bad cast and you put your fish down or whatever it is, do you ever just stop and say, how could I have fixed that? Do you look at your, I mean, past your cast. At some point, you know, I because of Bruce Richards, did a lot of that. One of the other one that I thought was pretty cool is casting through a hanging hula hoop that you have control, especially if you fish dry flies in tight cover. And we're on the Madison, right? There's nothing here.
There's not a tree yet, in the entire valley.
Yeah, but there's willows all over the banks. And as soon as you think there's not a thing that can get you, you're like, damn it, where'd that come from? And I am absolutely disgusted by people who trim trees so they can fish better.
Yeah, that's absurd.
That just bugs me.
Just learn to cast.
Yeah. Well, fish wins. You know, that's the whole point. Sometimes, otherwise you could have a groomed guy, you could have a golf course out there and have a freaking, you know, nothing. You could have no obstacles. I just hate it. But there was this one, I don't know who came up with it. The first time I saw it was one of Ennis casting events. And there was a taking your loop so you can tighten your loop and go through a hula hoop, right? It's like 20, 30 feet from you. But your line's got to go through. You got to control over your loop, you know, and then it's more fishy. It's more fishing-ish. But I think if you would get on the water, it's not always good. So you can sit and you can practice that stuff under real world scenarios. And just as soon as you catch the fish, you know, you miss them, put them down, do five more casts to them and say, okay, I should have done this. But we don't really do that. We get there. I mean, all you got to do is guide for 20, 30, 40 years and see how quickly an angler and even really good anglers, a good fish comes up. There's attention. I would love to put heart monitors on people.
You're standing at the free throw line.
Yeah, baby.
It's on the line.
And it's right? Here it is. This is the 3 points that wins the Super Bowl.
All the saltwater cats know that feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
Stand on and the front of the flats boat as that permit's coming at you.
Yeah, here it comes. And it's like, I can do this all day in my yard.
Yeah. But then when there's stakes, it matters.
Yeah, it's just... So do it on the water, too. I mean, I
think both. Yeah.
I think they're all great. You got nothing. And if you're not really controlled, I used to ask people to stand 20 feet from their car for their back cast. So their back cast never hit their car. Just anything that's an obstacle that tells you, so you get control of that back cast. Mm-hmm. That is your cast. That's your fishing cast. When you watch people unable to do a reach, unable to do a curve or whatever you're trying to do, it's generally because their back cast isn't complete. They just don't have control of their back cast. And so if you get them in control of that, so it's rote, so it just, you don't have to think about that, that helps a lot. But that should be more basic fly fishing. At this point, if you're talking about drifts and dry flies, you probably should have that part down.
Yeah.
But when you go out, that's the number one ill in all fly casting is, I think it is in golf too, rushing your back cast.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
It is. And
definitely a big problem in golf. I think, you know, practice on land, practice on water.
I want to put a casting pond out here.
We should. It would be
and
fun.
I think I'm going to this year, but mine's going to have movement in the water, but everything has an obstacle, a little bit more. There'll be a distance target for you, but there will be things that are more real to life. Like, you know, I like it. I still practice. I go out in the yard at lunch frequently and just, I don't know if I'd call it practicing. I just love watching the loop unfold.
Control,
do this, do that. You know, as you get older, I don't care who you are. You're going to have injuries. You're going to have shit. Matt's talking. How old's Matt?
25.
25. Shoulders killing him. Well, you know what? That happens to the whole world. Everybody's going to get tennis elbow or golfer's elbow, whatever. You're going to get this, you're going to get that. And you're going to have to work, and your shoulders are going to hurt, you know? I mean, what part of the whole push of spay was that, you know, older anglers not having to run a 9.5-8 weight for distance up to your belly button in water, you know? Gets old. And,
yeah, it does.
And so, but it can be, you have to work around it. Somebody wrote in. One of the questions they had was how I keep fit or whatever, about how do I do that? Well, I do it in a lot of pain.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm 11 surgeries in with everything on me has been broke.
We normally cut that out of the shows, but there's a lot of knees and
oh my God, it's like
forearms
now this
and elbows.
Damn elbow, the shoulder thing. I made it through my entire bodybuilding, the fighting thing, never had a shoulder issue. And I got shoulder issues when I got old, you know, just doing nothing, who knows? I saw some on the radio, and it's here. I heard it the other day about, I think it was Seinfeld, it might have been Ray, what's his name? I think it was that Ray guy from Everybody Loves Raymond, doing a stand-up. He goes, the thing about getting old, you go to bed, you feel great, and wake up, you got a sprained ankle. How can you have a sprained ankle? You don't have a, you know, have an ankle that didn't move all night.
Yeah.
You know? But the practice just to go out, and maybe you find, like when you work with somebody like Bruce Richards, I bring him up a lot. Bruce is a casting analyzer. Actually, he and Lord, what was his name? Oh, I'm so sorry, I forgot his name. I don't know. They came up with a casting analyzer. It was actually computer generated. Hmm. They did that 20 years ago.
No way.
But I mean, what Bruce will do for you, he gave up on me. You're a lost cause. I'm like that Jelly Roll song. And don't waste your time. He tried for 20 years to fix me, but didn't work. But what he'll do is he'll say, you know, just like a golf instructor does. You know, they just look at the angle of your elbow or your this or that, because without it, you just keep doing the same thing wrong.
Yeah.
So having been taught all that stuff, I go out and, you know, occasionally I'll say, I wonder if this would help alleviate my elbow. I mean, I can't tell you how many times people have walked in and told me they're got tennis elbow and they're just going to, Bruce got it. He was sure he got it from walking past a beam at 3M. He would bump his elbow on all the time.
No way.
But there's a guy that had, everybody has to go through the adversities, you know, even though it's not that physical of a sport, it sucks when something hurts. And
it's
so
a repetition injury, right? Yeah.
Well, that's what tennis elbow and golfers and all that is. And so, but by going out and just, you know, just see if, stand kind of kitty corner to the corner of your house and see if you can hook a curve cast around the, so a little bit of your fly's not showing, you can't see it.
Right.
And you make it go 8 inches off to the edge, great, you know, and just see if you can, but most people just go out and they cast and they want to shoot line. But I disagree with that. I don't think it's a, unless you want to be a tournament caster, but just to go, I don't see where that develops. Just like with golf, everything I hear in the world's about your short game.
Yep.
Short game, so is fishing. And there'll be so many people are going to write, and you're so full of shit. You're right, I am. But develop your short game. When Andy Mills, the most award-winning tarpon guy in the world, told me he gets most of his fish less than 30, that...
It means something.
I told the story before about sitting with a whole bunch of superstars, Billy Pate and Lenny Moffo and... God, there's a bunch of, we're all winded off, and we're sitting in the bar somewhere in the Keys. And it was after Billy Pate's tarpon series came out, which to me was the most, I sold so many of those. I'm addicted. I watch it all the time. I watch it on YouTube. And they don't have all three of them, though. I can't find them all. But he said something about 75-foot casts. And I asked him, I said, when's the last time you made a 75-foot cast to a tarpon? And he said, Well, I don't know if I ever have. I said, well, why'd you say it on that damn video then? What's good for teaching people how to double haul? Everybody, yeah, everybody suddenly that never fished tarpon in their life went and learned how to double haul. And I get out in the very limited salt water, but the times I have, I've never just thought, I mean, I don't see any 75. I wish we could pan this down here. This building's not with this. Let's
see if I can get a photo.
It's kind of hard. We're closed and there's stuff everywhere. But you need to go out and pace off what 75 feet is.
I mean, it's like 15 to 20 feet short of a fly line is what it is.
Yes.
And
then you've got you've got a target that's moving at 1 to 3 knots, right? And you got a guy in the back of the boat and a pulling platform you can't hit, and you got to aerialize 75 feet with some, if you're fishing and a big, you
well,
know,
very
9,
few
10,
people
12.
Can actually carry 75 feet line. So you might carry 40 but and then have to shoot 35.
The difference between Steve Ray, Jeff, what they always told me, the difference between him and everybody else was that he carried 77 feet when most people couldn't carry 70. How Bruce Richards ruined me was to take, he told me I had to be able to carry 70 feet of line for 5 false casts. I finally gave up. And I told him, I said, you ruined me with that. He goes, I never told you that in my life. He goes, 30 would be great.
Yeah, right.
I was like, you didn't tell me that? Maybe it was my ego. I don't know.
So back to the golf analogy, I think it's something I should do more. I've done it a few times, fly fishing, but when you watch these pros, right, Sunday's always the final day of the tournament. Generally, they get out Sunday night, maybe Monday. They show up to the next tournament on a Tuesday. They play practice rounds, right? Because prior knowledge is really important in golf to, like, know what the greens are like, know, you know, all your blind shots, anything like that. And so to bring that to fishing, especially dry fly fishing, I've done that before where I know a spinner fall is going to happen at, let's say, 8 p.m. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll go out there at 6 where I know I'm going to fish. I'll practice some casts, practice the hook. That's and especially where one of the places I really like to fish here, I am on river left. So that's facing downstream, the left side of the river, but I'm facing upstream. And, you know, there's bushes, there's trees and everything. And a lot of those fish are going to hang really tight to the bank. So you can't cast over your right side.
Mm-mm.
And I'm not a great lefty. I can cast a little bit lefty. I've tried to get better at it. But I do a lot of backhanded casts, and that's a great one to practice and have mm-hmm. some reps in before you go and it actually matters.
Yeah.
I mean, it's because that's not an easy cast, and it's really nice to have a little bit of warm-up before it means something.
I that's back to, you can do that in the yard too. But like you said, put the fish down. It's too early. They're not up. You're looking at your targets are out there. Your seams are there. They're telling you something.
Mm-hmm.
Cast your fly. You're just killing time. You're walking upstream. Stop and look and go, or downstream. Hey, how do I hit that one?
Yeah. And stand on a bank, cast upstream, cast downstream. Yeah. Go cross a bridge, go to the other side and try to do the same thing.
We just don't practice much. We get there and we start fishing. And sometimes that's detrimental.
I think often, but it's also really fun. And a lot of people, you know, a lot of people don't have enough time to go practice a bunch.
Well, that's why I said, if you blow it,
yeah,
just 5 casts. Just stop, think. You don't see anybody, you don't learn by just, you put the fish down. Well, just think about what happened and make some casts out there. The fish is gone. You're done. You know, you blew it.
There's no pressure anymore.
Fix it. And your cast will get better. And it's just, I mean, I do it all the time. I'll put a fish down. That's part of the whole, the three mistakes a night.
Mm-hmm.
If I blow it, I blow it. I only get 3 shots.
Well, and you're putting pressure on yourself, which is fun.
Yeah.
Then when you succeed,
but then you
got to
leave. You know, it's kind of like tying flies. When I say people don't practice tying flies, if you will cut a fly off, if it sucks and you take a razor blade and cut that thing off, you will not make that mistake next time.
Right.
And if you have to cut six flies in a row off, you're learning. Then things, you are learning.
Just learning through failure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cut the thing off, start all over. Or you just completely untie it. Just go backwards and say, okay, I'm not going to make the mistake. But when we fish, we just go to the next fish. Or we sit down and wait for a fish to come back. But we've not got any better.
On the topic of mistakes, going back to the, I think it was episode 5 of the fly show, 4 or 5, the Betis one up between the lakes, with the snow all around.
Such an ass kicking.
You know what the biggest mistake you made was?
Going fishing that day?
Yeah. Well, besides that, in the lot, you're like, I normally like to wade out there, but I'm not going to do that today because I only have an 8-foot rod.
Yes.
And then we get down there.
1971 Fenglass.
Yeah, yeah. Super slow. Not the rod for that necessarily. And immediately, you know, a big fish rises on the far side. You're like, oh, fuck it. I'm going after him. And that's, you know, it's hard.
A lot of things.
It's hard to cast a soft glass rod and, you know, carry 25 feet of line. When you're standing on a bank,
yeah,
it's really hard when you're standing stomach deep.
Yes,
you know?
That was still one of my favorite days ever, though.
So fun, yeah. And if you guys haven't watched that, go give it a watch. It was great.
I get my butt kicked. I did hook several of those. I don't.
You hooked a bunch of fish.
I don't get how those. I just don't get it because generally I hook better with softer rods.
Yeah.
And I just, because they were pulling line even and not coming. I don't know. Just a good memory.
It was falling. All right. Oh, go ahead.
I said if we killed it, I probably wouldn't have a good memory.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even remember we shot it.
All right. Well, I think that's a great spot to end episode 12. Come back next week, Tuesdays, 10 a.m. is when we try to release these things, Montana time. And yeah, questions, leave them in the comments. Anything you want us to talk about, we love hearing from our listeners. And we will see you next Tuesday.
See you then. Thanks for watching and listening. For those of you that don't watch, which I just found out, yeah. A lot of you don't watch.
Funny, podcasts.